I'm not going very far.
It's too uncomfortable.
I'm in a hurry.
Sometimes I just forget.
There's no such thing as a good excuse for not buckling up. You're not only putting yourself at risk of injury or death, it could also cost you lots of money. Cops are writing tickets, so why take the risk? Do the smart thing and start buckling up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Take the bass line out. Uh-huh.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Hardwood Knox Podcast. My name is Dan Favalli, coming at you with my super-duper, incredibly esteemed, awesome times awesome, fantabulous, spectaculario, super flexible when it comes to rescheduling podcasts, Andy D. Bailey Esquire. He is back. He did his law school finals. He is about to start prepping for the bar, but we're calling him Esquire officially.
I'll take it.
Yeah, before we dive into the playoff mailbag we'll get to, and of course I'll pick Andy's brain on his thoughts about the two conference final series going on right now, I just want to remind everyone to please rate, review, and subscribe to us on iTunes. That is still our best way of tracking the pod and your engagement and letting us know that you're, one, listening, and two, what you think about it. We love seeing those ratings go up, so please continue to take the 15 seconds out of your day to steal someone's phone or use your own phone, and go to iTunes, search Hardwood Knox, rate, review, and subscribe. We can also be found basically everywhere that there are podcasts now. So subscribe there, listen to us, whatever most convenient for you. And you can still get 15% off at the NBA Math Shop. That's nbamath.com/shop. Promo code Benno, B-E-N-O, should be easy to remember. You know why. But with all of that aside, Andy, how does it feel to be done with law school?
Well, it feels good to be done with school, that's for sure. But the law school is weird because you just get like a week off and then you do the hardest part of the whole thing, which is the bar prep.
I mean, so we'll see how that goes. What does the bar prep entail?
This is hilarious. Law students like go into thousands and thousands of dollars of debt to go to school for 3 years, and then they have to pay a third party to teach them how to take the only test that matters, which is the bar. And the company that I bought my bar prep from, I mean, you're basically like, you have to buy this bar prep stuff. There's really no other way to do it. But their big selling point was that if you go with this company, you'll get in-person instruction. It cost, between the bar application and the bar prep course, it was $4,000 to have access to a bunch of videos.
That's absurd.
So that's just another Andy Bailey rant on academia, which are seemingly endless at this point in my life.
Will you be tweeting whilst you take the bar? Will there be a stats thread?
My wife told me, so I'm probably going to go to like the public library to watch the videos so I'm not distracted at home. She's like, I'm going to be checking Twitter to make sure that you're focused, which is probably a good thing because I clearly was not in a lot of my classes. Didn't prevent me from passing though, so that's good.
Well, sweet. We wish you the best of luck in it. But you're Esquire in all of our hearts already. I just want you to know that.
I'll take it.
Before we hop into this mailbag, I wanted your quick thoughts. I'll start with Cavs Celtics. As we record this, Cleveland is down 2-0. Did you see this coming at all? Do you expect them to rebound? Have you noticed anything encouraging or something that you think they could fix in this series?
I really wish some enterprising Celtics fan had wasted a little bit of their life and just like kept track of how many times I've been wrong about the Celtics over the course of the season. There was the early season. What was that NBA math thing we were on? I can't remember what it was called.
The basket brawl.
Yeah, the debate
defunct
thing.
Basket brawl. Yes,
me versus you, which I triumphed in to no one's surprise.
I was shocked personally.
But I said they'd be around 500. It was like right after the Gordon Hayward injury. I wasn't even sure if they'd make the playoffs. Or, I figured they'd be like in that 8th, 9th, 10th range. They obviously blew that away. Then they beat the Bucks, who I picked to win in the first round because they had Giannis. I just thought, well, they've got the best player, and Boston doesn't have Kyrie. And Marcus Smart was even out at the start of the playoffs, I think. Then I picked the Sixers. Wrong again. Same sort of argument. I told myself there's more talent at the top with Philly. And I actually felt like that one was going to be pretty comfortable. I thought the Sixers might even, you know, sort of roll. And in this one, I thought Cleveland would roll, and that's obviously not happening. And I'm almost at a point where I can't justify picking against them much more. I guess my biggest takeaway from this series is that certainly there has to be more than just us and like other hardcore number people who believe that Al Horford is a star, right?
Oh my God, yes. It finally people are talking about it like this is a coming out party, and I think I'll say NBA Twitter has been pretty on top of it, and this is kind of just like an extension, maybe a more aggressive version of what Al Horford has always been, particularly the defensive end, the way people talk about him. It's like that's what Al Horford has done for a decade or more. Yep. It's just so it's good to see him finally get some shine, but it's funny that the talk has been about how Tristan Thompson's always owned him, which has been true, and then people don't understand the context of why sometimes his rebounding numbers are deflated. It's hysterical, but I hate the sector of NBA Twitter that's holier than now and talks like they're the only ones that watch certain players or certain teams. I think NBA Twitter as a whole, there are still some. I think NBA Twitter collectively for the most part has been on top of Al Horford for years now.
Yeah, and like you said, it's cool that he's finally sort of getting the shine. I guess more to the point of your actual question, it seems reasonable to think that Cleveland could just win two at home and suddenly we're like basically back to where we thought we would be. But they have some issues that I'm not sure they can resolve at this point. Their defense is atrocious. There are so many possessions in the first two games of this series where after maybe like two swings from side to side of the ball, some Celtics player will catch it with no Cavalier within 15 or 20 feet of him. I feel like that's happened, I don't know, 20 times in the first two games. That's just crazy to me. And I don't know, like I said, it's probably too late to recover from that, right? I mean, what sort of adjustments do you think they can make to turn this around?
Can they give a damn?
Because that would help. I was going to say besides LeBron just going absolutely insane, which I'm sure he'll do at some point. But yeah, you're onto something for sure.
It's I hate criticizing effort, but the Cavs honestly did not look like they cared for maybe on defense for the latter three quarters of game two, particularly. And with LeBron after that whole neck injury, it was sort of like he kind of checked out on the defensive end. He was just, or maybe they're trying to let him play that free safety role, but he's not even attempting to close out on shooters. And if he's banking on rotations to happen, they're not.
No. Yeah, they're not happening and they're not going to happen, I don't think.
So it's just like Boston scored 112.8 points per 100 possessions for this series. There are some things that could normalize. But here's kind of something that I had found interesting is that the Celtics are like, I just don't, do you look at anything of their performance like, oh, that's unsustainable? Like they're hitting 39.4% of their wide open threes for this series. They're of course getting like 17 of them a game, which is too many. That's probably not going to go down. They have all these shooters. The Cavs, conversely, maybe they'll normalize a bit. They're shooting 9 of 30 on wide open threes for the conference finals. That's only 30%. Like, that might help you, but the defense is just, pick and roll coverages are a mess. I don't understand Ty Lue's rotation, period, but I don't understand why he tries to make certain lineups happen. I kind of still expect them to win this series because of LeBron, but I'm at the point where it's, the Cavaliers at one point deserved the bare minimum benefit of the doubt, and I don't think they do anymore.
Yeah, I don't think they do either. And at this point, like I said earlier, it's probably time for me to start giving that to Boston. It doesn't seem to matter what happens. They just they continue to do what they do. It's crazy.
Yeah, Do you have them winning the series now? My Cavs in five pick is just torpedoed.
What did I say? Cavs in six?
I think you said Cavs in six, yeah.
I don't... It's so hard to make a pick at this point. Cavs in seven still seems like possible, but if I have to make a pick, I'm going to go ahead and say Boston.
I'm going to say Cavs in seven still, and I hope Celtics fans, if they're listening, they feel free to just roast me on Twitter. I don't feel... Yeah. It's just... what I don't feel good about the pick at all, but I'm still just... I refuse to pick against LeBron James before the NBA Finals. I just refuse
to. It also just feels like at some point there has to be a reality check for the Celtics. I've been waiting for one for months, so maybe it's stupid to keep waiting, but yeah. Doesn't it feel like that? It's in some degree?
Well, it's yeah, it does, particularly, maybe not particularly, because we've seen them go through kind of stretches of stagnancy on offense, although not so much anymore, but it seems like they're... or at least what I determined to be their ultimate downfall when you looked at from scratch shot creation was, well, you can turn to some different guys, Terry Rozier, Marcus Morris, Jaylen Brown, Jason Tatum, but the fact that you would need to turn to a guy like Marcus Morris, to me, was just this red flag. And now that we've played so much of the postseason, it looks like it's almost a strength because you have all those different guys who are getting more used to creating their own shots. You've had Al Horford be more aggressive on the point of attack when he's pump faking. So it's almost like this success by committee where you can bank on maybe not all NBA performances from any one player, but you can bank on two to three of those guys just being on and doing enough every single night. That makes them uniquely dangerous. And then, of course, we know what they can do on the defensive end.
Yeah. It just, the defensive end, like I think I've said this on the podcast a couple times, I feel like he could just pluck five guys off the street and have a, like, at least a moderate NBA defense. Last thing I'll say about this series is, even if they, you know, even if Cleveland comes back and wins, or if Boston wins and then gets crushed by whoever wins in the West, this is like, we've already talked about, this is like an exclamation point in Al Horford's career.
Oh, hell yeah.
He's been incredible for years, like we've said, but this playoff run is unbelievable, and particularly him. I would say he dominated Joel Embiid in the last series.
More than fair.
And that's, you know, like I said, that's quite an exclamation point for him at this point in his career.
The final thing I'll say on the series is the Cavaliers have no chance of winning if we can't get to a point and look at their roster and say, outside of LeBron, we know player X is going to show up. We can't go too deep in the depth chart anymore and say, you know, that guy is going to show up. And part of that's the rotation. You know, Larry Nance Jr. is all of a sudden playing again. High IQ defender. But could he catch a pass maybe without bobbling it on offense? That would be fantastic for them. It's just, we can't look at their roster and have any sort of confidence in it aside from LeBron. And I looked this up for an article I did. It was like a quick reaction piece to game two. Through each of the previous three seasons in Cleveland, the Cavaliers had two or more players entering the playoffs other than James, yielding a VORP, value over replacement player, of one or higher. In his 4 years with Miami, he always had at least four teammates with a VORP of 1.0 or higher. And this year...
In the playoffs, is that what you said?
No, this was entering the playoffs because it was just a larger sample size. And this year's Cavs have Kevin Love, and that's it. With the 1.0 or higher.
Yeah, it's not surprising, actually. But yeah, keep going.
This is very clearly the worst supporting cast he has ever had. And people can't look at the Cavaliers' salary and determine otherwise. That's the funniest take on Twitter at the moment, is looking at their salary and saying, oh, don't say he doesn't have help.
Yeah.
Whether it's
speaking
a byproduct
of funny takes.
Yeah, go ahead.
Have you seen the stuff about how we have to stop praising Brad Stevens because he's playing with lottery picks?
No. Is that a thing? I thought there'd
I've
been overpraised
for him. I've seen that a bunch of
times. Was like, oh, would you rather have Brad Stevens or a team of five LeBrons? Like that type of stuff. I actually thought it was going the other way.
Yeah, that's crazy too. But I've seen a couple takes that were like, I think it might have even been on the Jump. But they were saying, you know, Brad Stevens is great, but let's not pretend like he doesn't have two number three picks.
Oh my God.
Al Horford, Terry Rozier, who was almost a lottery pick. Like these are literal things that I've seen. And I wish I could remember who responded to it. I saw it on Twitter, but they were like, well, the Brooklyn Nets have two number three picks. So what are we doing here? It's, I don't know. It's just super hot takey.
It was, yeah, it's just, and to really quick wrap up the series with LeBron supporting cast, NBA Matt's founder and chief, founder and editor in chief, Adam Prommel, just published an article today about, is this the worst supporting cast LeBron ever had? And it clearly is. If you look at the total TPA of this team, it's just terrible. It's by far just the worst that he's ever had. And he compared, this was, I found this hysterical, non-LeBron members of the Cavs in this series are shooting, for the playoffs, actually. So non-LeBron members of the Cavs are slashing 42.5% overall shooting, 34.5% from beyond the rainbow, and 77.8% from the foul line. And that was, he ran a similarity model, and the two of the top three players that came up were Royce O'Neal and Andrew Harrison. So that's what LeBron has collectively as a supporting cast, is essentially Royce O'Neal, who had a good season with the Jazz, but I don't think you want him as your benchmark for a number two or three guy. And then Andrew Harrison.
Especially as an offensive right. player.
Warriors.
I'm not going very far.
It's too uncomfortable.
I'm in a hurry. Sometimes I just forget.
There's no such thing as a good excuse for not buckling up. You're not only putting yourself at risk of injury or death, it could also cost you lots of money. Cops are writing tickets, so why take the risk? Do the smart thing and start buckling up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.
Rockets, though. Are you more excited about the series after the Rockets were able to steal game two? I picked Warriors in five, and I'm not convinced that still won't happen. I could kind of see them running off a blowout in game three, then just winning game four because they're at home, and then the Rockets just being defeated. But maybe, in fact, we do have more of a series than I initially gave them credit for.
I had Warriors in six. I feel about the same as I did. I'm sure the Warriors are... they're probably not thrilled to have lost game two, but they did get the split. They still haven't had like a monster Stephen Curry game, which is coming. That's another thing that we've had a little bit too much hot take machine focus on. What's wrong with Stephen Curry? I think he'll be fine. I don't really feel any differently about this series than I did before. I think Houston showed in game two what we've been talking about all season, that they're not just an offensive machine. People who haven't been paying super close attention to the regular season maybe just think it's D'Antoni and Harden, and it's the same old story with D'Antoni teams. But they're very much a defensive team this year. I think they were top 10 in defensive efficiency in the regular season, and they've got a bunch of guys that they can throw at different players. I think the Rockets, along with the Celtics and the Warriors, they're near the forefront of sort of the positionless basketball revolution, and having Bamute and Ariza and Tucker to switch all over the perimeter has helped them defensively. And I think that's what won them game two, was better defense, not so much a different outcome on offense. So, yeah, long story short, I feel about the same. I think Houston has enough weapons and enough sort of defensive versatility to be able to get two wins in this series, but it's really hard for me to see anyone knocking off the Warriors at this point.
Yeah, I'm with everything you just said there, and their defense was super important. James Harden trying harder still wasn't great, but the fact that he can have a 9 of 24 shooting night, 3 of 15 from beyond the arc in game two, and you still win, it is a testament to what you're being able to do on defense. And then it finally helped that they had the, I'm not a Rockets fan despite the we, Eric Gordon just popped off, and he's been struggling pretty much all year with his efficiency. His on-off splits have always been, not so much in the playoffs, but for the regular season, they've been incredible, but his shooting percentages haven't been great. And PJ Tucker it's almost like...
he's been unbelievable in the playoffs.
Does he ever shoot above the break three? It's always in the corner, and I feel like the Warriors were just always off of him still.
It also feels like he never misses that corner three.
No, it's
every at least not for the last couple months.
Not that I've seen over the last year he hasn't missed a corner three. And do you know what was also funny? Was after game one, everyone just like yelling at the Rockets saying they do too much ISO. It was, have you watched the Rockets at all during the season or read about them or seen
anything
on Twitter?
That's literally all they did.
And I think there's merit to saying I'm always for like more off-ball movement from certain players, and it would be cool. Like, I want LeBron to be able to be the role man more. You could say that about the Cavs offense since he's come back. It would be great to have more off-ball movement, but like isolation and these simple pick and rolls and these kickouts, they're just the foundation of everything they did. And I thought there was more off-ball movement in game two, but it's really funny. Houston threw in the first game of the series 226 passes, and then that was game one. And then in game two, they threw 228. So two more passes. That's so it's funny. Not people can't come out and say they just abandoned their style completely. It was, as you said, they played better defense, and I do think there was a touch more off-ball movement, and maybe some. I didn't look up these numbers, but I think there was less dribbling overall for them. So that definitely helps. I think game three is going to set the tenor for the series, though, because I'm still worried that the Rockets don't measure up over a longer haul against the Warriors. But you kind of need, as you talked about, that trademark Stephen Curry game. And I also, I feel weird saying this because he's shooting really well for the series, but maybe a little bit less Kevin Durant. Does that mean, like, it's, I feel like the Warriors offense is better when... I would rather have Steph freelancing a ton than relying so much on Kevin Durant. Is that crazy?
I totally agree.
Oh, you do?
No, I completely agree with you. Did you see Draymond Green's mom's tweets about that?
No.
I don't know if she took him down, but somebody screenshotted him. This is another Twitter moment where I can't remember who did it, but she was going back and forth with some fan about she called Durant out like by name and said, enough with the ISOs.
It's just
and somebody responded to her. That. Yeah, and somebody responded to her, and she talked about how they need to swing the ball side to side, and she was making good points. I agree. Durant's an incredible offensive player, and he was one of the lone bright spots for the Warriors in game two, just from like a purely statistical standpoint. But they are absolutely at their best when the ball and all five players are flying around. And I think they've gotten into a tendency since he's been there, and I think it's more common this season than it was last season, for them to just sort of stand around and watch him ISO, which we just said that works great for Houston because they have two of the best ISO players ever, and Durant is obviously a great ISO scorer too, but it's not Golden State's identity. I think they're much, much better when ball and player movement are just at a 11. You know, right now they seem to be at like a 6 or 7.
That would be more fine if he's playing in lineups without Stephen Curry and Draymond Green, because even if you remove Steph from the equation, I still think everything you said kind of holds true because of what Draymond Green can do as a passer, and his decision making when just in terms of finding open guys when he's on the move is absurd.
Yep.
So the one thing that won't hold in this series, I'm guessing, is Stephen Curry shooting about. I don't even know what the raw percentage is, but he's shooting like 10% on open and wide open threes. And I know there's kind of like a weird the way like open is defined between 4 and 6 feet. That's still enough distance for defenders to kind of close out if they're long enough. But he's 1 of 11 on open and wide open threes total for this series. As you're talking about, maybe we don't get a Stephen Curry game. Perhaps he's still that MCL sprain, he's recovering from it. His off-the-dribble stuff inside the arc seems like it's fine, but it doesn't seem like he's flying around as much, even though I think he's been moving better than I kind of thought, especially looking at the end of the Pelican series, but that won't hold. I am interested to see, though, if there's just any, you know, was Steve Kerr looking at Draymond Green's mom's Twitter, and are there going to be adjustments made looking forward? Warriors have to stop playing anything resembling a traditional big in this series, though, and that includes David West. I don't even know. Kevon Looney's probably the limit. His touch on the offensive end is just bizarre. Even when he's trying to get like those tap backs, I just feel like he's destined to miss everything. And I say this knowing he's shooting 60% in the series, but he's attempted 5 shots. I think the Warriors kind of might need to try to force the issue more. Clint Capella is so valuable, even when he's not scoring to what the Rockets do, because of the pressure he puts on everyone and the work he forces Golden State to do on the glass, the screens he set on offense, it's not even just a matter of creating space for Harden and Paul, but because of the way he rolls, it's you have to, you know, unless you're going to stay off him, which you're probably not, you have to be up. And if you're taking that guy away from the rim, it's going to make Houston's offense a lot easier one way or the other. Either they're going to get to the basket, or as we kind of saw in game two, there's going to be shooters left wide open. Those are just some kind of things to monitor, but I think if you're the Warriors, maybe you try and dictate style of play just a little bit more.
I wonder if Jordan Bell could help him find like a middle ground between playing small and still having somebody who could like body Clint Capella.
I think you should probably give him any minutes.
He's only played 6 minutes in the series. Right. I mean, he hasn't played a lot in the playoffs in general.
And there's probably just, he's a rookie, and I think Steve Kerr doesn't like kind of like the way he runs the floor sometimes, I think I've seen. But I would give, and this is, we're talking about David West is averaging under 5 minutes per game for the series. I'd give him all of David West minutes and maybe let him eat into Looney's a little bit. And I you know what? I could
just kind of see what happens, I think.
And I could do with a little bit less of Nick Young as well. Yeah. He's shooting well from three, but his defense is almost, well, it's not almost, it's impressively bad. He did have that random, was it Harden? Did you see that in game two? That random.
Where he kind of stonewalled him for a second? Yeah.
It was Kevin Love's game seven moment, but it came for Nick Young in the conference finals game two with the Warriors trailing by a zillion.
Well, I'll take those moments anytime I can get them from Nick Young.
Yeah, so I think we'll both stick with our picks. I think yours is definitely closer. The Warriors in six kind of feels right, but I refuse to just back down just yet.
All right, let's jump into some mailbag questions.
I'm excited.
Okay. This is from Joshua Beal at Joshua F. Beal. And I'm pretty sure we've answered this exact question in previous episodes, but I think it's more interesting now that we've seen him in the playoffs. Donovan Mitchell or Jason Tatum?
It's tougher now, right? Or is it?
I feel like it is tougher for me. I say that, I don't even know where I came down on this question last time, but Tatum has made some headway in this debate.
Yeah. Damn, I don't know who I would pick.
It's hard.
I think I would still go Donovan Mitchell, and because I think he's eventually going to be an even better passer than he is now. You just look at the havoc he creates on his explosive drives, even when he's not even hitting shots. Like, the defense just goes into kind of this tizzy. And Jason Tatum, the way he's so smooth on pull-ups, even though I know that the shooting percentages don't always support it, I think that's kind of a notch under his belt. It looks like this time without Kyrie Irving and Gordon Hayward is going to make him super valuable as that from-scratch shot creator guy. He's going to be able to defend both forward positions. I mean, he could just defend basically across the board. They don't switch him as much as they do with Jaylen Brown, but he'll be fine there. Maybe this is me also knowing that Donovan Mitchell is going to have more control over his offense's fate than Jason Tatum when you look ahead to next season and see Gordon Hayward and Kyrie Irving in the mix. I would still go Donovan Mitchell, but in a vacuum, if we were to rip Tatum out from the Gordon Hayward, Kyrie Irving core in Boston, I think it's awfully close and definitely much closer than it was when we first answered this question.
Yeah, I think it's closer too. I think you basically hit on the point that still has me going Mitchell as well, and it's the fact that he's done this in a much, much more pressure-filled role. They had about the same box plus-minus this season. Mitchell's was 1.1, Tatum's is 1. In the playoffs, Mitchell's was 1.3 and Tatum's is 1.7. They had basically an identical PER in the playoffs. Tatum's a more efficient shooter right now. And I think another thing for Tatum is, and I know plenty of people have made jokes about Celtics fans for always bringing it up, but he is 2 years younger.
That's true.
20 years old right now, and 2 years of seasoning in the NBA, he could be a much different or much better player in 2 years. And the other thing that I think that goes in his favor is the size. He's very much built for the modern NBA to be one of these like 2-4 guys who can switch everything, who can do a little bit of everything. So I think there are a lot of points that would lead us to Jason Tatum. But Mitchell to me just has like this sort of undefinable star quality. It feels like a cop-out to say that. And then there's also the thing that we both already mentioned, the fact that he was like unquestionably the offensive alpha for them from, I don't know, 2 weeks into the season before he had basically taken over that team, at least on offense. And I, you know, he's already 21, or he was in his age 21 season, so he's a little bit further along in his developmental timetable than Tatum, but he's still got time to get better too. And he's already, I think Mike Schmitz at ESPN has mentioned this a bunch of times, like the strides that he's made from his junior year in high school to now are crazy. To go from like 6 or 7 points as a freshman in college to 14 or 15 as a sophomore to 20 in the NBA, that's just like a super steep incline in terms of his development. So I think he still has time to get better as well. But this rookie class in general is just crazy. I mean, it really, I know a lot of people wrote the article that's like, is this the next LeBron James, Dwayne Wade thing with Simmons and Mitchell? And I think we can throw Tatum in there too. I think the natural comparison with him is Melo, but I think he's going to be better than Melo.
Certainly on defense. He's already better spot-up shooter than Melo has really ever been. Maybe his peak Melo season, but
I'm not even sure. Yeah, I probably didn't even need to make the comp. I think it's pretty obvious.
Why are you selling Jason Tatum short?
Exactly. But yeah, long story short, this rookie class is incredible. He didn't ask this, but do we both still have Ben Simmons as like the clear leader of this group?
Yeah, I do.
I think I do too.
Because he's going to impact the game as a passer more than either of those two ever will.
For sure. I actually, there was one more thing on this. There was a cool Nylon Calculus posted something like right before we started recording. It was perfect. In the playoffs, points created per game, so I'm assuming this is points plus points generated by assists. Mitchell was at 34.5. Simmons was at 35.3. Tatum's at 25.6. Percentage of team total, Mitchell 33.7%, Simmons 32.4%, Tatum 24.4%. Two guys carrying a third of their team's offense, one carrying a quarter, and they're all rookies.
Oh my God.
And they all made it past the first round. Like, this is
nuts.
This is crazy what this group is doing.
Do you know what we might need to look at Tatum as? And this isn't to say that if you did look at it this way, he is better than Mitchell. The more interesting question to me at this point really is, who would you rather have, Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum? Which is, I know it's harder for me than it is for you, but if you just look at their roles, so Jason Tatum had like 45 and 48% of his offensive possessions came in transition or spot ups. Donovan Mitchell had 28% in those same categories. More than 40% of his offensive possessions came as the pick and roll ball handler. And when you look at that disparity in roles, if you want to evaluate Jason Tatum, it's kind of like that Klay Thompson situation. Because when he's going to play alongside Kyrie Irving, Gordon Hayward, you want to throw Al Horford in there, maybe even Jaylen Brown a little bit. Should they even trade for another star over the offseason? You have to imagine him in a different type of role. I don't want to. His efficiency is going to probably be inflated because of the talent around him and the role he plays within it, and that's not to take anything away. It's just that you look at what Klay Thompson does in Golden State, he tends to get overlooked, or people think he became overrated, but just because his role is kind of almost marginalized by design. So it's just, that's kind of where I'm at for me, is Jason Tatum is just never going to have that, maybe might never need to have that opportunity unless something happens with Boston's roster and they get rid of Hayward and or Kyrie at some point. That might just be how we have to kind of look at him.
It seems like we might not get that look at Tatum for like 4 or 5 years at least.
We probably eventually get it though.
Maybe eventually he becomes like the number one there. And I think that's within reason to expect that. But a lot of people talking about should they trade Hayward and Kyrie is crazy to me.
Yeah.
They at least have to try it for a year, right?
I would think, especially if they make it out of the Eastern Conference Finals, I wouldn't touch this roster, I don't think. It would be interesting to trade Kyrie Irving.
I mean, you're already adding two All-Stars to what they're doing in the playoffs.
Right, and if you can get to a point where you're just capitalizing on a bad situation, look, let's say the Kawhi situation, I still expect him to stay in San Antonio, but let's say it devolves and the Spurs are willing to take at the middle of next season salary fodder, and they've just re-signed Marcus Smart, and then picks, and you want to build an offer that way because you're going to get a lowball price, fine. I'm not even sure. if you just said, like, remove the actual financial logistics from it and said Kyrie or Gordon Hayward straight up for Leonard, I don't necessarily know that I would do either of those deals. And Kyrie Irving, using him as the anchor is a little bit interesting just because you know what you have in Terry Rozier, and you've seen that both Jaylen Brown and Jason Tatum can carry more of the offensive load, and you know that Leonard can carry the load. And with Kyrie Irving coming up on free agency, would you rather pay? Do you want the next 5 years of his career, or the next 5 years of Leonard's career? That's a fair question. And yeah, even with the Hayward injury, there's stuff there, but they're in the Eastern Conference Finals. I think you have to test it out for at least a year. Yeah. I'm with you.
That's what I was going to say. Even those questions are at least like 8 or 9 months away. Okay, let's move on to Justin/Default at xDefault with two T's. Where's Boogie going?
He unfollowed the Pelicans on Instagram.
I was going to say, somebody, I had a radio spot in Utah this morning, and he said that Boogie, I didn't know this, but he said Boogie unfollowed the Pelicans and followed Julius Randle. And somebody else, too, that was related to the Lakers, but I can't remember who it was. So it's that time of year where we're watching NBA stars social media game.
Did you see the explanation he gave for it?
I'm a grown man.
He said, I'm grown, and it's like, oh, nothing says hardcore adulting like taking the time to purge your Instagram feed of the franchise you've been with for the past 15 months. That's something you actively have to do. That's not that because I'm grown. He would be a fine consolation prize for the Lakers, or maybe if they don't want to get rid of Randle and they're planning on signing Paul George, and then you put Cousins there as well. I don't know. I wouldn't be crazy about a Randle-Cousins pairing, to be honest with you. Randle's position is center now. Even if you bring him off the bench still, creates all kinds of problems. Maybe it doesn't mean anything, but I honestly don't know to get to the question where he would sign. The Lakers would make sense if they need a placeholder and he's willing to sign a 1 or 2 year deal. Otherwise, it kind of seems like he could be a sign and trade candidate. Like, would Washington try and work something out with New Orleans? But then who are they willing to use as the salary anchor there to bring Cousins back? Even
I feel like their already terrible cap situation gets worse if they have Boogie.
That's true, because they're not getting rid of Jan Mahimi in that trade either. New Orleans wouldn't be interested in a Parker sign and trade for Boogie, like the dual sign. That's not really on the table. Toronto, maybe, if they were really looking to shake things up and New Orleans wanted Ibaka or maybe liked Valanciunas. But even then, if you're going to get rid of Boogie, it should be because you want to play Anthony Davis at center all the time. So I honestly don't know where he could go unless you have any other like ideas, just because the teams with cap space aren't really going to want him.
Yeah, in my notes, I just wrote LA with a question mark because I don't know. Other than New Orleans, that's the spot that made some sense to me before he got hurt. I liked the idea of like LeBron James, DeMarcus Cousins, pick and rolls, but
maybe Phoenix, if Ayton, they don't draft Ayton.
Yeah, that could be interesting. Are they going to have, how much cap space do they have? I know you just went through all this.
Yeah, they can get to, they like start with basically no cap space, but they can get to $20 million effortlessly. If you renounce Elfrid Payton and waive Alan Williams, you're basically right there.
And that's the other question with Boogie is how much is some team willing to give him? $20 million obviously isn't the max, but I don't see anybody giving him the max.
And if Phoenix was to give it to him long term, because they'll be at about $15 million if they get rid of Williams and Payton. There's other stuff they could do because they have some other small non-guaranteed salaries. They also have those expiring contracts for Dudley and Tyson Chandler. They could stretch them. They could probably find a home for Chandler, I would think. But if you're Boogie at $20 million over 3 years per year, that's a huge risk in itself. That might be a team because it looks like they're ready to be aggressive in advance of Booker's extension.
I don't have like a great answer to that question. The market is weird, and then it's like extra weird for big men this summer. This is another one about this summer that I think is
Milwaukee would be interesting if they were willing to the Pelicans could use someone like Snell, maybe an offer built around him. But I'm actually interested to see if Tony Snell can become like Mike Budenholzer's version of Damari Carroll now in Milwaukee. Like maybe Budenholzer will just unlock him.
He'll get more out of him for sure. Another offseason question from Aaron at Swaggy D's, D-E-E-S.
Oh, wow.
Do you see a lot of playoff teams unloading first-rounders and deadweight contracts for cap space this summer? And I put this one in as just sort of a discussion starter for the cap situation. Again, there's really nowhere for those teams to unload guys like that too, right?
Atlanta.
I mean, who's going to...
Atlanta is the team because they've come out and said it.
Okay, well, there's one. That's more than I had.
And they start the summer with, and this is before... If Dwayne Dedman and or Muscala opt out, this is a team that's going to have a ton of cap. If both of those guys opted out, they're probably looking at $30 million without doing anything. But just to start, when you factor in their three first-round pick holds, they're going to be at about 17.2 is what I have them projected at. That's if they renounce all the exceptions, which so they could really absorb some stuff. And if you're a team like Portland and have Evan Turner, if you're a team like – I don't know that the Magic would go rogue and try and get rid of the final $34 million on Biombo's deal. I don't think the Grizzlies have enough to sweeten Parsons is owed 49.2 over the next 2 years. Gorgui Dieng in Atlanta could be interesting if Minnesota's looking to just cut salary. If LeBron and Houston become a scenario and there's an opt-in and trade thing there, Atlanta might be a prime spot for Ryan Anderson to land 2 years, $41.7 million. They're the team to watch. I'm just... wondering it. So let's remove the part of is there even a spot for those bad contracts to go. Let's just say there is, and I think it's Atlanta. Chicago might be, they could do it, but I think a lot of people are worried they're gonna actually use their cap space.
They're gonna try to start winning. I think
that's stupid, objectively dumb. Just dumb.
But you can see it happening, right?
But they have, if they carry Zach LaVine's cap hold and along with their other non-guarantees and David Nwaba, his cap hold, they're going to have more than $23 million in room. It's just like, you know, so it's, they could do what Atlanta says they're going to do. But anyway, can you even see a team, though, willing to pay the price of dumping those salaries? Just like, what is it going to cost?
Like a first rounder with it or something?
Does a first rounder to Atlanta, if they have three in this year's draft, does a first rounder... in 2019, when they also have Cleveland's first rounder, will they take Evan Turner for that? Are you going to have to include two firsts?
Yeah, that's an interesting question.
I think there'll be spots. I don't know if there'll be teams maybe willing to pay the price that it'll take to get off those contracts.
Maybe Atlanta tells themselves that we can't have too many first round picks because maybe we can start packaging them and moving up.
Right.
In future drafts. But I mean, that's the only explanation I can come up with off the top of my head. But if they've already said that they want to do that, that's more than I realized was out there. I just figured it was going to be really tough to unload big salaries this summer.
Yeah,
and let's say Atlanta does take one or two, then are there any other teams that might get into that? I guess you said Chicago might. The Lakers aren't going to do it. They're the other team with a ton of cap space.
They could if they wanted to, but yeah, they're not. Imagine the Sixers taking on a bad contract in memoriam of
the Sixers and Lakers, their stated desire is to kind of go out and try to sign some stars.
This was Schlenk's exact quote, by the way. We're projecting as many as 16 teams could be looking at the luxury tax. We're going to be one of those seven teams that has really any significant cap space. We're going to look to use that cap space to relieve some of the financial troubles that other teams might be having to continue to gather assets.
That's really interesting to come right out and say that.
I appreciate that. It's just, I'm wondering.
Yeah, me too.
I'm interested to see what the price will be, because it's twofold. It's there will be probably few teams, even the Nets, they'll have some cap space, but I don't know that they're still going to be with their own draft commitments coming back. I don't know that they're necessarily still going to be in bad contract mode. So there will be teams that are willing to take on this bad money, but is this even the summer for teams that want to get off bad money to do it? Especially if you're doing it to get cap space, the free agent market isn't really that great when you look at the best players.
No, after like the top three, it gets...
Yeah, because you know Durant's going back to Golden State. Paul would be shocking if he left Houston. Most of these teams aren't going to be in the running for LeBron. Paul George seems to maybe he'll have a market of three teams that he'll choose from, like OKC, Philly, and LA would be, I don't know where else he would, I don't even know if he'll look at Philly, but that's how, so this might not be the summer to pay that premium, and maybe that balances it out. Maybe it will only take a first round pick to get rid of a guy like Turner, or maybe a guy like Myers Leonard. I honestly don't know.
All right, Eric Chud, at @Eric_Chud50. Which players do you think the Sixers will sign over the offseason? You started to get into this a little bit with your last answer. I'm gonna take Paul George and LeBron James off the table because those are like the obvious targets. Let's say they whiff on either one of those guys. Are there any? I have a few guys I think would be interesting there, but I'll let you go first.
So if I'm them, I don't know. If they aren't able to sign Paul George or LeBron James, I might try and wait out the Kawhi Leonard trade situation before I would sign anybody. Because
makes sense.
I think Will Barton could be interesting there. Tyreke Evans could be interesting there. But if you want to put someone else in Philly, I think they need to be non-ball dominant to the fullest extent because you already have Embiid and Simmons. It'd be different if we're talking about LeBron James, but. And I've said this before, Markel Fultz essentially needs to walk before he can crawl. Like, before you tell him to play off the ball more, you need to give him reps and let him work through whatever's going on with his jumper and figuring out his attack mode and what you have as a passer. If they, I think you go maybe you re-sign J.J. Redick, whether it's another placeholder deal or a discounted long-term pack. If you don't sign one of the big names, you immediately go to him. And then maybe an Avery Bradley or a Kentavious Caldwell-Pope would be interesting, although KCP falls in love with those pull-up, god-awful two-pointers in transition. But using him as more of a cutter, or the way they used Bell, because you imagine KCP and like Bellinelli's / Redick's role that we saw a lot during the first round of the playoffs and in the regular season, that would be interesting. Same with Avery Bradley.
You named all three of the guys I had listed.
I apologize. KCP.
No, that's perfect. KCP, J.J. Redick, and Tyreke Evans. I think I agree with you. I don't think I agree with you. I do agree with you that you want guys who don't take the ball out of Simmons' hands. So I think with Evans, I would sign him hoping that I could get most of his minutes without Simmons on the floor. Mm-hmm. You know, they'd probably have to share the floor for a little bit for Evans to get the kind of minutes that he needs. But and then the other thing I was looking for is I just think they need wings, which is what everybody needs right now. And Redick makes sense to re-sign. He had a great year there. I think KCP would be super interesting for all the reasons that you named. Those are the three guys I had. And I think Paul George makes a ton of sense there, but I think it's kind of Lakers or bust with him. That's sort of the sense that I get. And I know how crazy it sounds, but I'm still not in love with the idea of LeBron James and Ben Simmons on the same team.
Oh no, I wrote about it and I got hammered for it. I don't think it just, and this is probably more of, I want to see the most from every player on the team type of take, but
yeah,
you have LeBron coming in and maybe he does want to play off the ball more. That's not a transition that's going to happen right away. He's still the best player in the league. Ben Simmons doesn't have a semblance of a jump shot right now. Joel Embiid just shot terribly from 3-point range during the regular season. You don't know what Markel Fultz can really do. Paul George would be by far the better fit, but like you said, will he even look at Philly? One under the radar name, if they're going, they don't want to spend too much money. I'm not sure how much it would take to get him, but Doug McDermott in Philly could be super interesting.
Yeah, that could be interesting for sure. More and more shooting. He had a nice little stretch with Dallas. I'm not ready to give up on him yet.
Or maybe even, yeah, James Ennis too. He'd be a better defender, and you could probably get more out of his 3-point shot in Philly with the spacing they have.
Those guys are going to cost way less than the names that we mentioned.
So yeah, Doug McDermott's weird because he's restricted, and you don't want to have to. I don't know that. I would pay him mid-level money, and if that's what it took to get the Mavericks not to match, I'd probably pass.
That's true. All right, this next one, I packaged four questions, and I'm not even going to read the questions. Sorry, guys, but you all essentially asked the same thing. At Travis Leheine, Leehein, at Houston Corey, Corey, 713. At Luke W9 and at Baird Seth, BAIRD Seth. All, like I said, variations on the question of what's going to happen with Kawhi. And we've mentioned his name a bunch of times, but we haven't really dug into it.
Have we gone a podcast without mentioning Kawhi's name?
I don't think we have. He gets like probably an average of 5 to 10 minutes per episode from us. I'll just ask you straight up, and I think actually you did already say this earlier in the episode, but where is he playing next season?
I still think it's San Antonio. We've had just reports continue to come out. Ken Berger at Bleacher Report, I thought, published the best balance take, where he had executives both saying the situation is irreparable, and then there was other ones saying that everyone thinks Pop is going to still fix it. That's just, it seems too early to tell. And the most recent report, I think, said it'll take a grand slam offer for the Spurs to get rid of Kawhi Leonard, and that came from the Ringer's Kevin O'Connor. They're in a tough situation. I don't know why you would look to move him now. He is going to be in a contract year.
Unless he's just straight up said, I'm done.
Yeah, unless he demands
a trade. Which we
don't know. Yeah, we don't know that he said that. And here's the bigger thing for me. He also just played in 9 games during the regular season. Teams will trade for him, but how many are going to really give you adequate offers, knowing that he's had the quad injury now, that at least to him and his own group was serious enough to keep him out for mostly the entire year, and you're going to have to pay him a bunch of money in free agency in 2019. I just don't know what those offers are going to look like. We're at a point where I think if you were getting the Leonard that we saw in 2016, 2017, I would make fun of Celtics fans for saying, oh, I'm not giving up Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum in a trade for Leonard. You know what? I'm not giving up Jaylen Brown or Jason Tatum in a trade for Kawhi Leonard right now. It's just I'm not doing it, and that's why I think the Spurs ultimately keep him. What'll be interesting to me, though, is he is eligible for that designated player extension. It's worth about $219.2 million over 5 years. I'm not giving that to him either, and that's where I think the trade demand could come in. He would need to requalify for, it's a different name, it's a designated player contract or designated veteran contract. It's essentially, the rules are just nuanced, and he would need to requalify, and the easiest way would be making another All-NBA team. He could win Defensive Player of the Year, he could win MVP. I get the type of message that sends to Leonard is probably not great, but if I'm looking at the Spurs, if he's going to be Leonard, the Kawhi Leonard that they've known, he's going to make an All-NBA team next year. And if they've already taken care of him in 2015 free agency, where they made him wait instead of the extension so that they could work with a smaller cap hold, they should be able to come to that mutual agreement there. I understand that's not necessarily in the best interest of the player, but I'm keeping him, and I'm not giving him that extension either. I'm doing both, and I think it's absurd that we're at a point where it's the whole trope about, oh, coaches can't play a coach in the last year of a deal. You know what? They can. Players can play in the last year of their deal. And that's just where I'm at with the Spurs. I don't know if he stays. I do think there's a high likelihood they give him the extension, but I personally wouldn't do it. I'd keep him, and I still wouldn't give him the DPE right now.
So
you've gone back. You've been great.
I know. I feel like
you've
fluctuated
a ton.
I feel like a lot of the stuff we've seen suggests that it's broken enough that they're going to at least look this summer. And I'm sure they'll at least field some offers just to sort of see what's out there. I'm going to, just to be crazy, I'm going to say he is playing for a different team. But here's the thing that makes that really hard for me to say. The obvious destination is the Lakers. And there's that caveat with them that they can just wait. If he's going to sign with them in free agency anyway, then they can just wait. Now, there's inherent risk to that. Who knows what can happen during the time period when you are waiting. Maybe they sort things out with the Spurs and he's fine there. Maybe they trade him to a team that, you know, he falls in love with, and you miss out on your opportunity. But I think there are going to be a couple teams that might make these sort of grand slam offers for Kawhi, and If the relationship is broken enough, I think they'll have to at least think about it.
Phoenix would be an interesting team to do that, unless they think that Leonard is very Kyrie Irving and would threaten not to re-sign with them. But they'd be an interesting team. The Lakers, for me, under two circumstances, if I were them, I'd make the play for Leonard. Is if that gets Paul George and or LeBron to come, then you trade for Leonard. And if it's one of them, that's fine. Because, and this leaks into my other reason, and then you consider it if you don't get either one of them, should Luol Deng be part of the deal? I don't want to waste cap space and assets on Kawhi Leonard right now, especially if they're not going to sign one of James or Paul George. But if it's a matter of the Spurs will take back Luol Deng as a salary matcher, because you'll include Brandon Ingram and a future pick and Kyle Kuzma. If that deal is out there, I consider it. Still less likely to do it if they don't hit on a free agent or two this year. But if we're talking about them independently trading for Leonard without acquiring anyone else this summer, it has to be, to me, with Luol Deng included. That would be the incentive for them not to wait.
All right, this is another package one. At PJ Ramey, Ramey, at A Pot Tothamax, at AKAH24, and at Raja Panagrahi. Hopefully I pronounced that right. Essentially, it's what's the top three in the draft for you. Mine is, this should come as no shock to anybody, I still have Luka Doncic number one. I get why a lot of people think Phoenix is going to take Ayton. You know, physically, he's a monster. He put up huge numbers. He's got all the physical gifts that you want. I think signing Igor Kokoschkov has to mean at least a little bit of something. The fact that he was Doncic's coach for the Slovenian national team at Eurobasket. And I think they can embrace like the positionless basketball revolution by taking Doncic and playing him with Devin Booker and Josh Jackson and maybe even TJ Warren. I think you can have all four of those guys on the floor at the same time. So for me, it would be Doncic, Ayton, and I think I'm just sort of defaulting to Marvin Bagley at this point at number three, but I could hear arguments for Jaren Jackson, even Mohamed Bamba, who was super impressive at the combine yesterday. But for right now, my top two is Doncic and Ayton. And then one other thing I'll say about Ayton, because somebody told me he was a can't-miss prospect yesterday, and I'm not sure we can use that label with anybody, with all the surprises that we've seen with the NBA draft. Ayton had the exact same, within a tenth of a point, box plus minus, both offensive and defensive, as Jahlil Okafor at Duke.
Oh, boy.
He's got, like, much different physical tools than Okafor had, but to me, it's just, I don't think we can call anyone a can't-miss prospect.
I agree with pretty much everything you said. I'm more willing to, and I have Doncic over 8-2. We might end up looking like fools, though, because he does have his physical profile.
He's a beast.
Yeah. If he develops like into this really high IQ defender, then I'll totally, again, I'll have no problem conceding. I hope, but I guess I don't want Doncic or Ayton ending up on the Kings. That's just selfishly. No. But one of them's going to, which is sad. Third for me, and I think you kind of hit it on the head, I think there are a lot of players to consider there. I'm not as ready to default to Bagley as you are. Jaren Jackson is interesting to me, and I'm not ready to give up on Michael Porter either. That guy was the consensus number one pick, and
he's very interesting.
So, and it's interesting to see where he could fall. If Chicago is able to get him at 7 or something, some people think he might fall to Cleveland at 8, which would be an incredible get for them. I can't see him getting past the Bulls, though. They need wings pretty badly. But that would be my top three would be Doncic, Ayton, and I think I'm going to say Michael Porter. I don't know why I'm saying that, but I think he would be my third guy still. I understand why you wouldn't take him third, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Last thing on that, have you seen the stuff about Doncic maybe even staying in Europe if the Kings take him?
How funny. He didn't frame it specifically to the Kings, right? I remember not reading it. It just said he might not come out. He might stay in Real Madrid.
But before that quote even came out, though, there were some, like Jonathan Givney, I heard him on the Woj pod. There must be whispers about this, because he was saying it would be interesting if he stayed over if the Kings picked him. So I wonder if he heard that somewhere, and then the quote came out like 2 days after that.
It would be,
that's, he's got some leverage that you know college players just don't have,
right? And if he stayed, think about how interesting that would make next season, the first year of the new lottery format. That would be,
yeah, if you're the Kings and he's like basically comes out and says I'm not gonna go, then you can't take him, right? I'm not gonna waste a number two pick on a guy who might miss 2 or 3 years.
Yeah, I don't think you can either, especially because you don't own next year's pick.
Yeah, like, I feel like they'd almost have to go somewhere else.
But if he stayed, it would be, I mean, he's only 19. He turns 20 in February. He's not,
yeah.
He could still and be fine. So that would be really interesting.
Okay, another draft question. This is from at I'm just going to spell it. D-O-U-M-B-E-L-A-C-H-E-M-I-Z. Dumbo Alchemist. That's what I'll say. Did you look at the draft class? Which non-lottery player do you like? And I only... we could probably talk about this a lot, but the one that jumps out to me for the last, you know, few weeks is this guy named Zanon Moussa. He's another European who's... he's not playing in quite as high quality as a league as Doncic. He's in the Adriatic League, which is still, you know, pretty good competition. I would say it's still definitely better than the NCAA. And he's also a teenager. He's 19. He's averaging double figures, shooting almost 40% from three. He's 6'8". So he's, I mean, he checks a lot of the boxes that you would want. He's very interesting to me. I hope to, you know, maybe he'll do some workouts, but if he's playing in the Adriatic League, that's probably not going to happen. But he's an interesting one to me. I don't know if you have any non-lottery guys that you're kind of keeping an eye on.
Jalen Brunson's really interesting to me. And yeah, I would wonder where he'd even fall in the first round. I feel like picking Smith would be kind of a cop out because he could just as easily go in the lottery. But that would probably be really about it. Lonnie Walker, maybe. But Jalen Brunson's always been kind of super interest to me. And I'm hoping he ends up somewhere good at player development, or who is... does well at player development. And just looking at the outside lottery teams, if he goes in the late 20s is probably his best bet. If he could end up in like a Boston or a Golden State or a Brooklyn or even in Atlanta, who has that 30th pick, 19th is probably a big reach for him.
All right. Do you want to rapid fire the rest of these?
Yeah.
All right. Desmond Smith at DESIS, or it's just going to be at DESI Smith 24. Why are people forgetting that CP3 is a free agent? No way Houston pays him. He's 33 for his last, looking for his last payday, right? Maybe this isn't a good one to rapid fire because this could go in a bunch of different directions. But we've talked about this for sure on the podcast. Do we really want to be on the hook for Chris Paul's last contract, something that might pay him until he's 38? I think the first couple years, if you give him a max, are probably going to be worth it. He was first in the entire NBA in real plus minus this season. The question, of course, becomes at what point does he drop off? How steep is the drop off? Do you want to be paying him like $30 million plus, or, you know, $40 million plus when he's in his mid to late 30s? It's a real question. And I guess the other question is, would he sign for like 2 or 3 years? I don't think so, but maybe if he's there with Harden and LeBron, it's an easier decision for him. There's a lot of different factors.
Well, the other thing is where would he go if the Rockets aren't offering the max? In the interest of keeping this like semi-quick, I agree with everything you just said. Maybe he signs for less than the max in Houston in exchange for getting the longer-term deal, because we saw the market didn't let Kyle Lowry really get more than 3 years from the Raptors last year. It could be something similar with Paul. I don't think the Lakers would pay him just to bring in LeBron, and they can't. To afford both of them would cost them about $71 million next year. That's not cap space there, really.
Man, yeah, that's crazy.
So I can't see him leaving Houston, and he would at some point. You can't do this 1 year hopping. I'm not saying he's done this because he was with the Clippers for a while, but you're going to leave Houston after 1 year and go where? Is going to win a title immediately or over the next couple years? I would still like to see him on the Spurs. If he was going to leave, I just want to see the Spurs get cap space and sign him. But I would be shocked if he left Houston. Honestly shocked.
The lack of cap space this summer is going to make so many things so interesting.
And it's not even the lack of cap space. It is, but it's also the teams that have the cap space shouldn't be paying these guys
for sure.
That
yeah.
could go in the market, be looking for money from elsewhere.
It's almost, last thing on this, it's hard to name like five guys that you should really want to spend $40 to $50 million per year on when there's $100 million salary cap. The John Wall contract already looks terrible.
Same with the Russ contract, to be honest.
Yeah.
I still think it's better than the Wall contract, but
half of your salary cap to one player, that's just like crippling, no matter how good they are.
These designated player extensions have definitely made they've made things super interesting because I think you're right. They're probably only right now, if we took age or experience out of the equation, because Giannis Antetokounmpo isn't eligible to sign it right now. Anthony Davis isn't eligible to sign it yet. But those two, LeBron, if you could tell me Kawhi would actually be healthy, but I wouldn't give
like
it
I
to
agree
right
that
now.
Those guys are worth it. But even then, it's so hard to build a team after you spend half your cap on one guy.
Those are players that I think there are probably between three and five or six players that I think you don't really need to hesitate on, though, just because it's better to keep them happy and on your team
Like I said, I think it's worth it. It brings a bunch of interesting questions I don't think we have dealt with before, really. All right, at Free Jesse Buggs, JESSEBUGGS. With a better offensive system and time to develop chemistry and communication on defense, isn't the Cavs roster hypothetically perfect for LeBron in general and a legitimate challenge to the Warriors? Hill, Hood, Korver, Smith, Green should be a really good wing core next to Braun, in my opinion.
Whoa.
So hypothetically, sure. You got a bunch of big wings who hypothetically can shoot and hypothetically can switch on defense. But in a more realistic world, none of those guys he named, with the exception of Hill, from time to time, can play any defense. That seems like a little bit of a slight to Kyle Korver, who I think is good, like, positional defender, but he lacks the foot speed and sort of the lateral quickness to be a great defender. And we talked about this when we talked about the Cavs-Celtics series earlier. They are just a mess defensively, and I don't think time to develop chemistry and communication on defense is going to fix some of these individual defenders.
100% with you right there. It did kind of bring me to an interesting...
But the other thing, sorry, one more thing is, when they made the trades, we were all kind of saying what he just said in his question. Maybe not you specifically, but I feel like I did, and I know I heard it from other people that, oh man, this is a roster that makes sense for LeBron James. I especially thought that with George Hill. So I think the question is at least reasonable, but after the evidence that we've seen, it's hard for me to imagine this being the right core for LeBron.
I'm with you. I'm actually mad at myself for not being harder on them for the trades, because I initially didn't like them, but I kind of talked myself into them in real time when I was doing grades, and I think you looked on paper. I was higher on Larry Nance Jr. than I would be right now, but some of that might just be coaching or how you use him. It's just, no, this is not the perfect roster for LeBron. You look at George Hill's health history, and now he's almost unafraid to shoot, and you can't rely on J.R. Smith the way you can. Korver's a good fit. I think you can even say that Hill's a good fit, but Love should be a good fit. Now, he falls in that Hill category, just underperforming for these random protracted periods. Someone like Rodney Hood has always been overrated, particularly on the defensive end, and kind of as this off-ball guy.
Talk about a guy with an interesting summer.
You talking about all this, though, made me think that maybe one of the selling points for the Cavs to LeBron is that they could have cap space in 2019. George Hill, non-guaranteed deal for $1 million. J.R. Smith, the final year of his deal, which is valued at $15.7 million, there's less than $4 million guaranteed. Kyle Korver, about half his salary is guaranteed, but you probably keep him. With Jordan Clarkson and Tristan Thompson entering the final year of their deals, then you could talk yourself, maybe a team, into absorbing one of them, or at least you could take back a cheaper contract. Maybe you're willing to stretch one of them. That creates room. And if Kevin Love opts out or you've moved him, you're really – LeBron's salary is going to take up a huge chunk. If he gets the max with his 8% raise, he's probably looking at like $36 million and change in his salary at what's the exact number? He'll be making like $38.2 million that year. There are some stuff they could do, and that might be a selling point. You can trade for someone with that number 8 pick now, but there are a lot of interesting things you could do in the summer of 2019 to try and build a roster that actually works with him, because this one doesn't. You at least need guys that you can count on looking at their effort. It's just that Kyle Korver, you can count on him. Everyone else, I don't, and Kevin Love, I think he always tries hard on the glass, but he can become disengaged very easily if he misses bunnies on the offensive end.
I'm with you. All right, this is another package deal. At Evil Hamster ENT and at Juicy Hoosie, HUSI. Thoughts on the Budenholzer hire is basically the the gist of this question. The other one was, where do you rank him as a coach? I went through all the teams when I saw this question, and these are guys that I think I would feel somewhat comfortable saying are a better coach than Mike Budenholzer, and I think that there are arguments with a lot of these. Brad Stevens, Eric Spoelstra, Quinn Snyder, Steve Kerr, Mike D'Antoni, Greg Popovich, and Rick Carlisle. And like I said, I'm not 100% certain on all of those. So I think top 10 is pretty comfortable for Coach Bud, and I like it for the Bucks. I think he'll bring some. He'll certainly have them playing a better defense than the scrambling scheme they ran for the last few years under Kidd. I think they'll be a little bit more imaginative on offense. I think he'll unlock some things with an Antetokounmpo that we haven't seen before. So I like the hire, and I think he's fairly comfortably a top 10 coach.
I'm with you on everything you just said. And it's the passing should go up in Milwaukee. Atlanta, yeah, with him is very consistently ranked in the top five of assist percentage, where Milwaukee has kind of fluctuated there. I think they were actually in the top five last year. And then this year, they were 15th in assist percentage. And everything you said on the defense holds. Top 10 definitely seems fair.
At underscore Prince CB, how good is Hassan Whiteside's trade value?
It is non-existent. Let's move on.
I was going to say it's terrible. It's going to be really hard to find a place for him. Antiquity, at Antiquity with three Ys. You'll love this one. Do you think baiting the refs into foul calls, such as James Harden does, should be looked at it by the NBA? They've already looked at it, and it didn't really do anything. That's my answer.
And I
they
do.
They made the James Harden rule, and it didn't do anything.
Here's my thing. I think it eventually does end up hurting players in the postseason. When you look at kind of how Harden's free throw rate went down this year, there are calls that you're not going to get in the playoffs that you would during the regular season, and if you're used to playing like that and you're not really able to adjust.
True.
James Harden has the step back to rely on. When that thing's going in, there's nothing you could do. So I you tend to get more heated about this stuff, flopping and things like that, than I do. But you know,
to your point, Harden's free throw rate is down about 14% from the regular season.
It's the lowest of his postseason career, right? His free throw.
So you're on to something there. Yes, it is.
And part of that's the Jazz. Part of that's the Jazz, I will say. Like, part of that's just the Jazz. But I think we've seen it with Lou Williams last year. I think we've seen it with Eric Gordon a couple times now.
DeMar DeRozan.
Yeah. Oh, DeMar DeRozan for sure. So
the only other thing I'll say on that one is, whatever happened to the flopping fines?
Are they just like...
It seems like they just got rid of those without saying anything. But I say bring that back. I say suspend people for the whole season if they flop. But
anyway. I'm going to interject with one from Tim Stubbs. He's a friend of the pod and from NBA Math, at StubHub, StubHub. Can you name some of the more underappreciated wing defenders of the 1990s, asking for a friend? It's interesting because not that there weren't good wing defenders in the 90s. You had Scottie Pippen, but it was just you had Gary Payton. It was just all big everything then, it seemed like. Someone like Robert Horry stands out to me immediately because he was just known as like that just big shot maker, but he was good on the defensive end as well. Prime Grant Hill, oh man, in the late 90s.
Yeah.
He would be in there. I don't know if anyone springs to mind for you.
I went to the player season finder before we started recording to see if I could get some help with this question. And the issues with defensive box plus minus, I think most people know. They say right on the website that you can throw it out if the reputation trumps the number. But I just looked at the best defensive box plus minuses from the 90s. Nate McMillan, I think he's generally known as a good defender, but I don't hear a ton about him. But just about everybody in the top like 20 to 30 are all big men. So that goes to what you were saying.
I guess Magic Johnson could count there.
Yeah. That Charlie Ward near the top 50.
Charlie Ward was in the top 50. That's spectacular.
Near the top 50. He was 54th. As I scroll through the list, it's like...
Oh, man, and we're doing the 90s too. And here I am disregarding Magic Johnson. That was like a huge brain fart.
Well, he did play a couple seasons in the 90s, right? But that was after he came back. Ron Harper.
Oh, that's a good one.
Brian Russell. Near and dear to my heart. Jordan pushed off. Yeah, that's about all I got. Like, I think your answer is sufficient. It was so many big men. And defensive box plus minus still rewards big men to this day, so I should make that clear as well. Okay, Kevin, at Colorado, except for the first two O's are actually zeros. How did the Nuggets become a playoff team?
Have Paul Millsap healthy for a full season.
Paul Millsap healthy helps. I think Jamal Murray and Devin Harris need to be a little bit better defensively, and I think they can upgrade at the three. And I don't know where that comes from.
That's why not signing Jokic this summer is interesting, if it's at all interesting to them. Because if you work with that smaller cap hold next year, when you have the team option on Millsap and Arthur Chandler, assuming they opt in, they'll be off the books next year. Ditto for Kenneth Faried. They need a wing, but I'm with you on the, if you let the core marinate, Gary Harris might even have some improvement left in him, but certainly Jamal Murray does. And Jokic is probably going to get better.
Yeah, Jokic is what, 22 years old, 21? So they still have time. Maybe it is just internal development, but I think they can get a little bit better on the fringes.
And Jokic is 23, he's old. I take it back, he's not improving. 23.
Old man. At Taylor Dalton, 24, this is our last one. Do you think the Celtics have a legit shot at the title if they get past the Cavs? And I know I told myself and the whole audience earlier that I've been wrong about the Cavs or the Celtics tons of times, but I don't think they have a prayer against the Rockets or the Warriors.
I'm going to say the same. I'm still not convinced that you're going to make it past the Cavs, but as you said, we've just been off on the Celtics. And they would be they might be a more, if we're looking at it just between the Cavs and the Celtics, do you think you could make a case that the Celtics have a better chance of beating either of those teams than Cleveland at this point? And I think you can, because of what they're able to do.
Yeah, I think you can make that argument for sure. Yeah. All right. I think that wraps us up with today's mailbag. If we didn't get to your question, apologies for that. Keep sending them to us, because this is one of my favorite things to do on the podcast. I love the questions that you guys send. Until next time, you can find us on Twitter. Dan's at Dan Favale, Favale. I'm at Andrew D. Bailey. The show's at Hardwood Knox. The sponsor is at NBA _math. There's a really fun thing happening at the NBA Math Twitter account right now. Follow along with hashtag Time Machine Draft. We're all drafting across NBA history to come up with like our all-time historic lineups. It's really fun. You'll learn
about the reaction to my Chris Paul pick. 08-09 Chris Paul, one of the best 10 individual seasons in NBA history.
It was incredible, and I came to your defense on that one. That and I think Stephen Curry were the only ones that I like quote tweeted, because there was kind of a harsh reaction to Curry as well. I would also like to point out that I have the highest GPA so far. My LeBron pick got rave reviews.
Shocker. Yeah, and you had the best, because you didn't even have to make the initial pick. Someone else picked Jordan, so the decision was made for you.
As soon as Adam told me you got the number two pick, I was like, yes, I don't have to do the LeBron MJ thing. Because I would have taken LeBron number one, and I'm sure a lot of people would have graded that harshly. So, I lucked out and got the number two pick. Anyway, follow NBA _math. Go to NBAMath.com/shop and buy some of those really cool t-shirts. And enter the promo code Benno, B-E-N-O, to get 15% off those t-shirts or any other stuff at the NBA Math shop. Finally, once again, leave us reviews, leave us ratings, subscribe. Now, if you have friends who don't have an iPhone or an iPad or anything like that, they can find the show on Google Play. We're still on, Stitcher as well. So we're available on whatever device you have and however you listen to podcasts. Find us. We are eternally grateful for that. And until next time, we leave you with a shout out to Benno Udry and to Kyle Anderson.
I'm not going very far.
It's too uncomfortable.
I'm in a hurry. Sometimes I just forget.
There's no such thing as a good excuse for not buckling up. You're not only putting yourself at risk of injury or death, it could also cost you lots of money. Cops are writing tickets, so why take the risk? Do the smart thing and start buckling up every trip, day or night. Click it or ticket. Paid for by NHTSA.